You ate 12 moon pies, 3 dozen McNuggets, and you watched all of the Home Alone sequels? That's what you did all day?
I find this line of interrogation fairly meaningless. What is your point?
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Another sweet and savory episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film podcast, so good, it just has to be fattening. These movies are like the lost shoes along the highway of cinema history. We snatch them up, we dust them off, and we pair them with a sloppy, sugary junk food item that represents that viewing. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and with me as always is my friend and co-pilot, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And I want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes, and if you've been listening to us on iTunes and you haven't left a rating or a review on there, we'd really appreciate you doing that. Let us know what
you think
of the show.
For the love of God, do it already. Do it. We've been asking you for a year now.
We've gotten
like
glowing reviews on there, and frankly, I'm just a little bit embarrassed, so even if you don't like the show, leave something there just to keep us from getting egos. We're also available on Stitcher, although I don't know how their review system works, because I still haven't figured out the voodoo that is Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. While March is here, and while much of the nation turns its attention to college hoops, we thought we'd contract our own special strain of March Madness.
Oh, yeah.
So all month long, we'll be examining some of our favorite flicks about crazies, about madmen, and General Wackadoos. Are there any movies where there's a character named General Wackadoo? Because I feel like that should probably happen.
I feel like I'm supposed to salute and then feel really bad about the final episode of How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, sad face. Well, something that isn't sad face is the first movie we have up on deck. It's a film that will make you even more afraid of old folks than the sex talks in Cocoon, and that is Alone in the Dark.
Alone in the Dark from New Line Cinema. Anything can happen when you're alone in the dark.
From 1982, and I want to stress this, I said 1982.
Not 2005.
Not 2005 with Christian Slater and Tara Reid.
1982.
1982. You should expect nothing less here. This is a film directed by Jack Sholder. Jack Sholder is an interesting filmmaker because he had this brief window of time when he was making some really, really fascinating stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He made this. He did The Nightmare on Elm Street 2. And then he did a movie called The Hidden, which is absolutely phenomenal and doesn't get it. But this is his first film. And not only is this his first film, this is a film that was produced by this fledgling up-and-coming company called New Line Cinema.
Yeah.
This is, purportedly, I've seen a couple sources say it's the second, a couple more say it's the first, but purportedly this is the first film that they ever produced. So it's Jack Sholder's first, directorial debut, and it's the first film produced by New Line Cinema, which is why one of the co-writers on the film is Mr. Robert Shea.
Yeah. And it's interesting, this film comes in 1982, and as many of you know, 1982 is not only one of the best years of cinema of all time.
True.
But it is also the tail end of the slasher film glut.
Right.
Where, that was triggered in 1980 by Friday the 13th, and then we saw 2 years of just slasher films, and just about every week there was a new slasher film out, and Alone in the Dark is the answer to all those slasher films.
Absolutely.
Saying, what have we not seen yet? And the answer is, how about a whole bunch of slashers.
See, and I think that has to do with where Jack Sholder was in his career when this movie came about, because he worked as a film editor for a long time, and when he hit his early 30s and he hadn't made, and these are his words, when he hit his early 30s and hadn't made his Citizen Kane yet, he got to believe that it would never happen, that he'd never be able to really get into the business and make the films he was passionate about. So I think he had just enough of that cynical edge, just enough of that sort of self-defeatism that when he makes a slasher film in 1982, when he works with Bob Shea, because he also co-wrote the script with Bob Shea.
Yeah.
When he sits down to write this movie, he writes something that is so completely counter to a slasher film that it kind of, it irritates me to my core that people lump this in with traditional slasher films, because it's nothing like that at all.
No, it's really, it's a real, why I said it's an answer to that is because it really is a counter slasher film.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting in all the choices it makes that veer so differently from what everything else is, which is why I feel like this film has been abandoned.
Yeah.
Why this is one of those abandoned pieces of cinema that, you know, is only passed around by hardcore cinemaphiles, because it's one of those things that just isn't what you expect and not what you go to, what you want to get out of this era of slasher filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's something that's really special and truly unique. There Definitely. Is not another film that is like this one. It is its own beast, whether you love it or merely dislike it, because you can't hate this movie.
No.
This is not a hateable film.
There's nothing hateable about it at all. And to give you the completely reductive log line, and I'm doing this on purpose because I think this is just going to help us understand and put the building blocks on why this is such a special movie. It's a group of escaped inmates of an asylum going after their doctor and kind of sieging him in his own home.
Yeah.
So that's the, like, the most reductive bargain basement version of the plot synopsis. But here's something interesting I found while doing research. The original concept for this movie was that it was going to take place. Now, it does take place during a blackout in this small town. But apparently, the original idea that Jack Shoulder came up with is that it was going to take place in New York during a blackout, and the mafia was going to be called in to help stop the psychopaths. That is a very different movie.
Yes, it is.
Than the one we got. And apparently, the reason that we got the movie we got is somebody went, we don't have the budget to do any of that because we're a brand new company called New Line.
And that shows where the inspiration comes from. Because, I mean, the inspiration for this movie stems from the blackouts in New York City and the various riots that happened in the 70s. There was, I forget what it was, 77 or 78?
77 is like the year in the 70s in New York where New York is like the most dangerous place on the planet.
Yeah. You've got Son of Sam running around, you've got blackouts, you've got, you know, just craziness. And this movie is clearly a reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the undertones of this movie, there's clearly a lot of political stuff like going on.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Not just overtly, but, you know, in the subtext of the movie. But you gave the log line, but I think what really makes this movie interesting is just how, what makes this movie interesting and counter to those other films is that we see who these psychopaths are, and they have very reasonable logic for why they're going after their doctor. Yeah. They're going after their doctor because they've come to believe one of them has become convinced that their previous doctor, who they all loved and left for another job, was killed and replaced by their new doctor.
Yeah.
So they hate their new doctor. And when there's a blackout, which lets them out of the asylum, they work together as a team to go and get revenge for the doctor that they love.
I think the core of this movie and what keeps it from being another run-of-the-mill slasher film is the depth and specificity of its crazies. I mean, first of all, you have Jack Palance and Martin Landau as the two anchors of this quartet
and
of crazies.
This is the big selling point of the movie.
Yeah.
Like when you're actually pitching it to someone to watch, listen to me now, hear me later, you know, this is Jack Palance and Martin Landau as the psychopaths.
Yes. Joined by the guy who played Dynamo in Running Man, the giant belighted gentleman. And then a fourth member who does not show his face at the beginning. And it's going to be very important later. We'll get into that in just a moment. But
and starring opposite them, ironically,
running the asylum.
Running the asylum is, of course,
Donald Pleasance.
And let's do your Donald Pleasance again.
He should not be let out of the asylum.
There, now it's
because
done.
He's Jack Palance.
But we'll get into what's so great about Donald Pleasance there. But ironically, the doctor who these crazies are after is Dwight Schultz, who you'll all remember as Howling Mad Murdoch,
yes,
from the A-Team. He's the same person in this movie.
How?
Get that through your head. Dwight Schultz is the same person in the movie.
Howling Mad is the howling sane person in this movie. And how badly do you think by the end of Act 3, Howling Mad wants the rest of the A-Team in on this?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
he's got the A-Team of crazy coming at him. So.
Oh, yeah. And you talk about the depth of these characters. We'll probably end up talking about each one because each one of these characters is a really interestingly drawn character.
And it all stems from Jack Shoulder's inspiration for this movie, which was a Scottish psychiatrist named R.D. Lang. And R.D. Lang had this theory that...
R.D. Lang?
Not R.D. Lang. R.D. Lang. L-A-I-N-G. No, not comedian R.D. Lang. But basically, this psychiatrist theorized that psychotics were just people who couldn't deal with the already psychotic world. They had trouble adapting to the world because the world is psychotic. And so much of this movie and so much of the crafting of these characters is kind of based upon that idea. And in fact, Donald Pleasance's character is sort of a send-up of Lang, which is really interesting. And you have, because of that, because of this theory... you have the idea that the psychopaths are the ones being tormented. And that first scene of the movie, the very first scene of the movie where Martin Landau walks into a diner, I mean, you can't help but feel for the guy because he's having this horrific nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, we know from frame one that he's one of the people in the asylum, but because we see the hellish nightmares that he's having, I mean, your heart immediately goes out to him.
Oh, yeah. And it doesn't really... come together until we've got this wonderful scene later. When you realize just how you get the impression that the guy running the asylum, Donald Pleasance, is not altogether there.
Yeah.
You get that impression. It isn't till you don't realize how far out there he is until you put together this dream at the beginning where Martin Landau walks into a diner. You know, there's flames shooting up in the background like it's hell. Mm-hmm. He's served this giant uncooked fish. And then, you know, Donald Pleasance comes out with a, you know, sword and is about to hack him in half.
Yeah.
And then later on in the movie, when Martin Landau is kind of freaking out, Donald Pleasance just walks up and very calmly whispers in his ear. And you know, the other doctor is like, oh, what did you say to him? He goes,
I told him if he didn't stop all this nonsense, I would hoist him up and cut him in half.
And you're just like, what the fuck kind of asylum is like? This guy is literally nuts. Like, he gets his patients only because he's like almost there with his patients.
Right. I think it's so fascinating, too, that when you look at the motivation of these four characters and why they're doing what they're doing, there's nothing in their mind even remotely malicious about what they're doing, because they see it as, not only did he kill our beloved doctor, he's going to kill us next.
Yeah.
We've got to defend ourselves. We've got to get out of here and we got to stop him. So we, seeing it from their perspective, like, it's so much more interesting than someone who just throws on a mask and goes and butchers people. I mean, these are really complicated characters who we have. I mean, you can make the argument that there's one character among the quartet you don't have a lot of empathy for, but, you know, 75% of this group...
Who do you think that is?
I would say it's probably the child molester in the group.
Yeah. I would feel that, but he's at least I think of all the characters, the best performance but the weakest drawn is Jack Palance.
Hmm.
I feel like he's the only character we don't really totally grok. We don't really get a profound understanding of him. Like, at least the child molester, you understand and has some really amazing scenes. In fact, I would argue that the best moments of tension in this film involve him.
Well, sure. But that's specifically because we have an expectation from him to do the most harm and to, you know, to be the most wretched. So I agree that there's not a lot to the background of Jack Palance's character. We don't learn a lot about him, but there is something about his performance. And I would put both his performance and Martin Landau's performance, you know, near the top of their respective careers.
Oh, yeah.
And I would fight anyone that says differently. Like, these are amazing, legitimate,
You know, let's run down the characters. Let's get this all out. So of course you've got Dwight Schultz. He's very cardboard.
Super cardboard.
And not his fault, you know, just his character. He's just a family man. He's moving to a new job. He's the everyman in this situation. He's brought in to, you know, oversee, you know, various patients, including the psychopaths on the third floor, the psychopath ward.
Yeah.
And,
but I will say this about him. You can tell he legitimately cares about these guys.
Oh yeah.
Like he's kind of wooden and he's kind of just a straight-laced family guy, but you can definitely tell that he is trying to help these guys. He's not just being shoved in there as a replacement. Yeah. He legitimately cares.
You've got Donald Pleasance, who's the ultra liberal doctor.
Yes.
And a very broad send up of liberalism. Like this movie, I have this feeling like that Jack Shoulder, I don't know what his politics are, but I get the impression that he's very right-leaning because this movie seems to poke a lot of fun at liberals.
Which would be interesting considering how gay Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is.
Yes, although it's how homophobic Nightmare on Elm Street 2 kind of is.
I think if it's homophobic, it doesn't realize. It's one of those homophobes that's like you have to stop once in a while and go, you know, if you keep screaming about this, it's just going to become more obvious that you're closeted, because that movie is super gay.
Yes, but this movie seems to like to poke at liberalism. And then, of course, you have your genuine psychopaths. You got Jack Palance, who is just a straight-up psychopath.
Yes, he is playing Frank Hawks, a former military guy, and it's just, he's got these bursts of intensity that I think are so, like, when he first meets his doctor, his new doctor, and he's Dwight Schultz's character, and he just kind of turns around and he's like, Dr. Bonner! He hasn't said anything, and he just screams this, and then he's just like, happy trails. And it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Get away from me.
And then you've got Martin Landau, who is playing
Byron Preacher Sutcliffe.
Yes, he's an ex-preacher who now burns down churches, not necessarily when they're empty.
Yeah, very, very interesting turn for him, I think.
And who suffers terrible nightmares about his doctor killing him.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have
Fatty, played by Erlen Van Litt, who is, again, the dynamo from Running Man.
And he is a creepy, creepy he's described as a 400-pound child molester.
Yes.
And then we have The Mask.
We have Skaggs, also known as The Bleeder. Now,
The Bleeder.
If we talk any more about him, I should warn you that there are going to be some spoilers here. So just
let's avoid the big spoilers till later. But
okay.
Essentially,
but
he won't let anyone see his face. And
he's called The Bleeder because anytime he's in the commission of a murder, his nose starts gushing blood.
Yes. And so these are our cast of characters, along with the stock family and stock babysitter, who are our main the other characters that show up.
Well, I'm sorry, the babysitter character in this movie might as well have been wearing a red sweater, because she could not have been more expendable.
Oh, I swear to God, she's only there
because
of that era.
Because they're courting the idea. And there's a couple moments.
We need a blonde who will take her shirt off and have sex with her boyfriend while she's babysitting.
Right.
Because that's sexy. It's 1982. And that's what people are paying for on Friday night. So let's just get that out of the way, because the rest of this movie's all talky, talky, talky.
Yeah, because they're consciously
and actors.
They're consciously courting the look and the feel of a traditional slasher film. And I think this is one of two very distinct moments where you feel that they're poking fun at slasher films while they're convincing the audience that that's exactly what they're watching.
Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah.
But so the family is, you know, it's the plucky little, plucky little 9-year-old girl and the typical loving mother and the whore babysitter and the stupid boyfriend who comes only to get laid and killed. And those are all your other, you have a cop character who shows up briefly at the end, who's not really worth mentioning.
Yeah.
Because he's target practice.
Yeah.
Although the black guy does survive past the first kill of the movie.
That's true.
We don't
see him until after four people are already dead, but you know.
But then he
which is kind of cheating
for more than 5 minutes.
Yeah, kind of cheating, but you know, fair enough.
Oh wait, no, I'm wrong. I'm totally wrong, because there's another African American in the film and he is killed very early on.
Yep. That is absolutely true.
So they do the guard, actually, they do play by those rules.
That's true. The guard on their ward. Who's okay, and I want to say this too about the kills in this movie, is that, again, even though this is a film that wants you to believe it's just another slasher film, that wants to get people in seats, you know, kind of riding those coattails, these kills are brutal. They're unsettling.
They're not fun.
And they're not fun. No, and I love that so much about it.
Well, and that's the thing about this movie. And the reason why this movie is worth devoting a whole episode to is this is an oddball slasher film in which the whole point is to allow the audience to empathize with the slashers without rooting for them.
Right.
Because there's a difference there. There's, you know, there's that moment where everything kind of flipped. Like after, I want to say it's like 1984, 1985, where, you know, just slasher movies, just it after Nightmare on Elm Street 2, the switch got flipped, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're supposed to be rooting for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of rooting for the slashers to kill all these horrible people, but you're not really empathizing with them. And here, that's what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to feel for Martin Landau. You're supposed to know that this is a fucked up dude who needs help.
Right.
And he needs the right kind of help, but he's still dangerous.
Yeah.
And so this movie is an interesting balance of allowing us to feel for these characters without wanting to see them actually succeed in their psychotic plan.
Because we can understand the thought process that got them to the conclusion that they're at, but we obviously know they're wrong. So, I mean, you empathize, but at the same time, I think they do a decent enough job developing this family, and they're kind of quirky. There's a sister-in-law that's really into, like, reggae, new wave, and punk. She's just kind of a music freak. I think she's the super token liberal of the family. She is,
but she's also had a mental breakdown.
Yes.
Because almost no one in this movie is normal.
Right.
Like, the only people who are truly normal in this film are the family, like the core family.
Yeah.
The mom, the dad, who's the psychiatrist, and the daughter. And they are the only people who have not suffered some major mental breakdown or are on the verge of it.
And yet they really do push the idea of how fragile the idea of normal is.
Yeah.
Like, if you notice throughout the movie, and it's never, ever, ever addressed, the daughter swears like a sailor.
Oh, yeah.
And they never say anything about it. Like, they break a vase toward the beginning of the movie, and she's like, God damn it. And no one says anything to her.
No.
And she does it throughout the movie, and it's like, what is going on? Like, clearly everyone in this family has got something wrong with them.
Well, that was one of the background things that I get the feeling with this movie. You know, there's so much in this movie that seems to be poking fun at the liberalism of the 70s. And which moves in with, you know, the brand new dawn, you know, it's morning in America of the Reagan era.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, conservatism's back. The kid swears, mom is up with the sister-in-law smoking pot, and the daughter walks in and goes, mom, you're smoking pot. 9-year-old girl goes, mom, you're smoking pot again. You know, that stuff's not good for you. And it's, you know, the mom and sister-in-law then go out to a anti-nuclear power rally and get arrested and end up in jail.
Yeah.
And when the dad hears about it, he's not shocked that they got arrested. Like, that's not even remotely like, why did you get arrested? It was like almost like it was expected. And he cares more about the ramifications of that than he does even wondering why his wife is in jail.
Yeah.
And this goes throughout. And when you couple all of that, those weird family dynamics with, you know, the entire, you know, the whole reason this happens is because, you know, ultra liberal doctor thinker, who's running this asylum has decided he doesn't want locks and chains and bars holding in these psychopaths. It's all electricity, and they keep driving that. And it's you know, they're
but the third time he says, well, they're protected by electricity. I'm like, you know that's going to fail.
Yes.
Okay? I've seen Jurassic Park. I know this shit works.
Well, at this point, nobody had seen Jurassic Park because it was 11 years away.
Right, but well, I live in a
post-Jurassic Park era.
You know what? I perceive time differently than most people, okay? Yes.
But yeah, but so, you know, he and the living conditions up there, it's just very relaxed. It's very homey. It looks like the rest of it, they're just kept in by electric doors so that when the electricity fails, they can get out. So, you know, this entire movie seems to be the failure of liberalism to contain the craziness that is society. And it's an interesting thesis and an expression of that thesis. Whether you agree with it or not, it's a really interesting, because it's not Lone Wolf McQuade. It's not, it's not ultra right wing. It's just more satirical of liberalism, and it's very smart about its satire.
Well, what it is it's one of the most subversive horror films I think you'll see from the 80s. Because so specifically that it's not out and out right wing, because it's not overtly pushing one message over another, it's just kind of poking fun. And it's poking fun in a way that doesn't even distract from what's going on in the movie. But getting back to for a second to the kills, there's one scene that I think is so powerful that really drives home the difference between this film and a traditional slasher movie, is there's a scene where the mother of the family, her sister-in-law is being choked out by a crazy person, and the only course of action at this point is to stab him, but she's never killed anyone before. You know, in most slasher films, like, okay, Friday the 13th Part 4, little tiny Corey Feldman can just pick up a machete and hack the guy to pieces. That's not, like, if you've never killed anyone, it's not as easy as just stick the knife in and you're done. And the moment, like, there's so much hesitation because she knows she has to do it to save her family member, but there's just like this, she doesn't want to do it. And then the agony that she feels after she does it was so realistic to me. And it's something you never, ever see in a slasher film.
The other thing, that entire siege sequence is the big fuck you, the big divergence from every other slasher film of that era. Why do the people that survive? They never split up.
Yes.
They never go, oh, I'm going to go check upstairs. The whole family stays together. And when they fight the psychopaths, they work together.
Yeah,
the little girl pulls out the knife and hands it to mom and goes, here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how they survive, because they're smart people in a fucked up situation working together, which is the counter to every other slasher film ever, which is how you end up with something like Cabin in the Woods that completely satirizes and guts that entire genre.
Mm-hmm.
This movie refuses to play by any of those rules. It is entire counter programming to the entire slasher film era.
And I think another great middle finger to, like, oh, we're totally a regular slasher movie. No, we're not. Fuck you. Is that they could legitimately put on the poster, Tom Savini does the special effects, because Tom Savini did the special effects for one scene, one shot, where the sister-in-law, like, after they're being sieged, she's starting, like, again, the mental breakdown is taking over, and she goes up to a bedroom, and there's this really effective, really creepy scare where she just sees this thing, like, of come out at her, and it's like her manifestation of all of the stress and anguish they're going through just kind of coming at her. That is the one thing Tom Savini did in the whole movie.
Yeah, that's the best effect of the movie.
It's the best effect in the movie, but it's not the gore.
No.
It's not gore at all.
It's just a weird kind of zombie monster thing.
But can you imagine telling a hardcore horror fan at that time, we got Tom Savini to do the effects, and it's not the gore. It's literally one scene. Like, that to me is the most, like, we're going to buck everything because fuck you.
Yeah.
And this is Miramax shot across the bow. This is the first film out of the gate.
New Line.
I'm sorry, yeah, New Line's, like, right out of the gate here. And I'm just like, I love the chances they're taking immediately with this film.
Yeah. It's a really bold, interesting film that still plays. The first time I saw it, I was fortunate enough to see it projected on 35. And it's a wonderfully shot film. It's a very cool film of the era. It's very evocative of the era.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a fan of this era of filmmaking, this doesn't look like the cheap slasher films.
That's true.
This was aiming at the look of the more, the bigger budget movies. It didn't quite have the budget to look like Poltergeist, which, you know, came out the same year. But instead it has that kind of look and feel of those other films.
But it was going to do its damnedest to be Poltergeist.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's such a smart, cool little film. And yeah. it's one of those that I feel like there's a lot of films that we talk about on this show where you have to forgive a few things. It's like, look, you'll have to forgive the budget. You'll have to forgive this performance. You'll have to forgive the goopiness of it. This isn't one of those.
No.
This movie is genuinely good.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why we can't find it anywhere.
And I mean, yeah, there's a DVD out that's not easy to find. We still don't have a Blu-ray of it, to my knowledge.
No, I can't find one.
Yeah, and you know, it's
not available streaming.
No,
I had to end up rewatching it on YouTube, yep. Which was kind of embarrassing. It's just kind of like, really, I can't. Netflix doesn't have it. Amazon doesn't.
I own the DVD, but I had to buy it off like a private seller on Amazon because it was out of print. But going back for just a second to how subversive this movie is, and also how much empathy you feel for these psychopaths. Let's go back to what Artie Lang said about Artie Lang said about psychopaths not being able to adjust to a psychotic world. Let's look at the world that these four escapees escape into. As soon as they get out of the asylum, because of the blackout, people are looting.
Yeah.
So they walk out into pure chaos where people are just taking whatever they want, where there are literally weapons at their fingertips that no one stops them from taking because they are looting a hardware store. It's also people are protesting nuclear power and screaming about how it's going to kill them all at any second. And the local popular music club features a band called the Sick Fucks singing Chop Up Your Mother while people substitute pointless violent thrashing for dancing. I mean, well, it's like that's the world they enter. Oh, yeah. How the hell are we supposed to expect them to do anything but what they do?
Well, and it's interesting, the final shot of this movie,
oh my god, it's so good,
is one of the characters, one of the psychopaths at that club with a punk rock girl, and the punk rock girl is turned on by how psychotic this character is coming across. And it's very much everything in this movie is making a commentary.
Yeah.
This is cinema masquerading as schlock.
Yeah.
And that theme is prevalent throughout the entire film. The idea of a world gone mad and psychopaths blending right in.
Yeah.
And it's really smart stuff. But yeah, all of those elements are very much at play with what he's trying to say about our world.
Yeah.
And you know, what he's and the era that he's satirizing.
And what I love about that scene with the punk girl is that earlier in the movie, Donald Pleasance is having a conversation at the asylum with a woman who is a patient, an inmate. And the woman is saying, and I'm not, this is what she literally tells him, that every night her intestines come out of her mouth and try to choke her. And if she doesn't say the Lord's Prayer backwards three times, she turns into porcelain. Nothing that punk girl says during her babbling at the end of the movie is any more coherent than that.
No.
And that is why you see this look come over Jack Palance's face like, huh. This is exactly where I belong. This is the world that I know. And it's such an interesting jab at, I don't know if it's just like the culture of the era, if it's specifically punk culture, if it's specifically youth culture, I don't know what it is, but it is such a fitting kind of bookend to where the movie started.
Despite it being made in 82, I really feel like this entire film is a reaction to the 70s. I mean, the thing about nuclear power, you know, they specifically reference 3 Mile Island. You know, the blackouts of 77 had looting. You know, the
yep,
people,
absolutely.
You know, it, there was looting.
I mean, most blackouts have looting.
In this day and age, Austin can black out for 6 hours and nobody feels like, oh my god, somebody's going to come in and steal our shit. Like, you don't have looting in the streets. You have major cities have blackouts and don't have that kind of reaction.
But do they have blackouts for that long? I can't remember the last time a major city had a blackout.
Oh, sure, especially after storms. I mean, and you'll get, you know, some looting, but not like that. Not like what happened where, you know, entire nights of blackout, you know, led to craziness and fires and looting and
that's
violence.
True.
And I feel like this film is very much a reaction to all of that stuff and coming out of it. And keep in mind, we've talked about this many times, you know, the nihilism of 70s cinema bled into the genre cinema of the early 80s, when people felt like things were only getting worse and they could not get better and that society was coming to an end. And where you could put post-apocalyptic films in the theaters and say in the year 1997, and people would be like, oh yeah, no, by the year 1997, this whole place is going to be fucked. Mm-hmm. You know, acid rain and nuclear holocaust and the oil wars, you know.
And the sick fucks.
And the sick fucks playing their 20th reunion concert. You know, there was this real feeling. And I feel like that's what this film at its heart is really about. It's a much more, you know, it's a much more horror oriented version of our world is going mad and so mad that a psychopath can blend in and find his own place.
Definitely.
And you know, that whole scene at the end, and we won't say who it is, but that whole scene at the end with that psychopath, you know, all he does is act like a fucking psychopath and people cheer him on and he ends up getting the girl. Like, it's fucked up, but it's well done.
Yeah, there is that moment where the psychopath is walking into the club and the guy at the door is like, $6 cover, hey asshole, you didn't pay. And he just bashes the guy's head in until he's knocked out. And everyone outside is like, yay!
Yeah, because
like,
they don't have to pay the cover.
Fuck is wrong with you? I love that scene. Now, I know we said we didn't want to spoil too much, but I really want to talk about this bleeder character.
yeah, you do.
He's really fascinating to me. So we're going to continue on in the section, but just consider this your spoiler alert. Exactly. Okay, so apparently, first of all, the bleeder was Bob Shea's idea entirely. Bob Shea liked the idea of not only the character, you know, having the nosebleed every time he tried to commit a murder, but also being somebody who was, he liked having that element of a whodunit. Like, and that's what I think is so interesting about the structural turn that, I mean, they really do play around with not only, not only the tropes of a slasher film, but also, you know, a siege film as well, because we are introduced to the psychopaths. We know who they are, and yet we don't see one guy's face. So simultaneously, we know exactly who they are, and yet there's still one wild card. There's still that. So you get kind of both angles of the slasher film. You get the, it's obviously this this franchise baddie that we're, you know, we want the audience to root for, Jason Voorhees, Freddy Krueger, what have you. And then you also get the more giallo type slashers where it's like, ooh, you got to figure out who's the one doing it. Things like Prom Night and April Fool's Day, things like that. So I think it's interesting that they're able to kind of have their cake and eat it too in that way. But also, the reason the bleeder is such a fascinating character to me is that the actor playing him, a guy named Philip Clark, absolutely does an amazing job of selling this, like, really I mean, if you're following the movie at all, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay? It's not difficult. But the smokescreen that they throw up is that he plays this character, this sort of everyman who's just there to help the girls when they get arrested. Like, you know, he's in the cell with them and yeah, take my phone call, whatever. He's so disarmingly charming and nice that you still like him, even though part of you is going, I know exactly who that fucking is. I know exactly how this is going to play out. And yet he's playing two very distinct characters in this movie at
the
same time.
He's playing Ted Bundy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's the Ted Bundy serial, which is so interesting. Considering that when we're introduced to him, he's scratching the walls. He doesn't want to look at anybody. He doesn't talk. And there's this great moment. There's this great moment during the looting where to keep his identity concealed at this point, he grabs a mask from the hardware store. And it just so happens to be a hockey mask. And to me, that was like a direct send up, a direct poke at Friday the 13th.
Except he doesn't get the mask till part 3, which came out in 82, right?
I
felt like it was just synchronous.
Ah, I guess, you know what? You might be right.
Because part 3 is where he gets the mask.
Yeah, because part 2 he was still wearing a bag. So yeah, wow. So it really may have just been
pure synchronicity.
Kismet, yeah. Killer kismet. I like that. All right. Fair enough. But yeah, I think his performance is kind of the unsung one in the whole movie. Because he really does this amazing job of, like, when he's, because he's there with them as things are being sieged, like, and he's there, like, helping them. He's at certain points fighting off his own brothers. And then, like, when that turn comes, which, by the way, is the silliest point in the movie, The silliest point in the movie is how much blood ends up on that girl's face before she notices something is wrong. It's like, you're basically getting blood cockied before you even realize.
That's why you wanted, you just wanted to use the word blood cockied.
I literally just thought of that. It's not even on the notes, but, but you know what? Inspiration comes in many forms. But yeah, no, I think it's interesting that you have a character playing two very different roles as one crazy person. I think Ted Bundy's a really interesting way to put it because he does wear that mask of sanity really well.
But what's interesting, what I really find fascinating is that, he really seems to be, when you understand who he is and watch the dynamic and seeing him, you know, help them fight off the guys coming for, you know, the other psychopaths, you're like, oh, well, shit, he feels like he found a home, you know, and then when they realize who he is and they freak out and the mask is, you know, the true mask is off, you know, when they know who he really is now. Then he turns back into that guy, and it's such a fascinating character twist. It's such an interesting character progression.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. And indicative of this film, of the fact that, you know, these characters aren't complicated. The scene I want to talk about, as much as you're fascinated with the bleeder, I am absolutely fascinated with what they do with the child molester. There is the best, most tense 5 minutes of this movie is not during the siege. It's earlier in the day when the child molester has convinced the 9-year-old girl that mom has sent him to babysit because their normal babysitter is busy.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get her to go upstairs into the bedroom with him. It's like, come on, we'll go have fun. And she's just a pain in the ass, and she's been a pain in the ass the whole movie. So it's not that she's particularly distrusting of him, but
she just doesn't like being told what to do.
She doesn't like being told what to do.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps, you know, the tension going in this film is, you know, that this guy is gonna, you know, probably get his way, and you're waiting for that shoe to drop. But he's not just going to attack her. Like, that's not his MO.
Yeah.
And it's just, you're just sitting there going, I don't even like this girl. This girl's obnoxious. And I really, really don't want to see this happen.
Yeah.
And it's really such a well-structured scene.
And it's doubly interesting considering how big that guy is. And the fact that that actor was actually a weightlifter. And later in that scene, or later on in the film, he picks up the babysitter with his bare hands and just holds her up by her neck. Yeah, there was no special effect for that. He just did that on set. So he's got all of this physical power. He could easily overpower this 9-year-old girl, but it's more about this weird, twisted game that he's playing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is very unsettling.
Creepy.
And, you know, that's, again, this movie is not going for cheap scares at any point. This movie doesn't want to be cheap in any regard. It's not shortchanging the audience at all in any aspect.
Except for the policeman character.
Except for the policeman character. But I mean,
one flaw of this film, the one, and it's not a terrible flaw. It just, as well structured and well put together and well written as the rest of this movie is, they invite the police detective out of like 20 policemen who have showed up at their house to stick around for dinner. And then he goes, you know, he gets like two lines, and then they start the siege. He goes outside to check out what's going on and gets instantly killed.
Yeah, the two lines are, what was that? And I'll go check it out.
Yeah.
Things you don't fucking say.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, if the police weren't inept in these movies, nothing would ever get done. And by that, I mean nothing would ever get exciting. So I understand that's something to be forgiven, but I can easily forgive that.
Yeah, no, and it's not really bad, but compared to how good the rest of this movie is, it just feels really out of place and a little too on the nose.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the rest of this movie, everything is earned.
Absolutely.
Like, even the twist that you talked about where it's like, come on, you know, anybody who knows the language of cinema is going to see this twist coming. They still earn the twist.
And in fact,
the moment that happens, the blood cocky scene, as you so elegantly put it.
You're welcome.
Is a really emotional moment where they just hold on it, and they just hold on this blood dripping, not out of his nose, but just dripping onto her face and her seeing the wetness of it. 'Cause she's crying.
Yeah.
So there's this aspect of it. Like, maybe she just thinks this is her own tears, and you're just watching, and you're like, oh fuck, this is about to happen.
Well, and I think it works on two levels. If you figure it out, if you're paying attention, you figure it out, then it becomes suspense because you're wondering when that facade is going to be broken. And if you don't pay attention, you don't notice it, then it is a legitimate twist.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it works either way.
I agree. And it's, but that's what I'm saying is like so much of this movie earns even what some people might want to, to cheapen. It's never cheap. Except for this moment, this stuff with the police detective, who I don't think we ever even learned his name.
I don't know.
Like, detective, do you want to stay for dinner? Okay. wait, what was that? I'll go check. Thunk. And that's, that's the extent of the deepness.
Should it be called Detective Boyfriend?
Detective Boyfriend.
What happens to boyfriends in these movies.
Yeah, well, that's what happens to the boyfriend in this movie, too.
Yeah, exactly.
He's the classic Halloween, Friday the 13th boyfriend. He's like, oh, let me see your boobs. Oh, I'll go check what's in the closet.
It's like, the minute he shows up, it's like, you've shown up to your murder.
Yeah.
Congratulations, you're dead.
Yeah.
I want to talk real quickly about the Sick Fucks, the band in this movie, because there's two pretty hilarious anecdotes about them. The first is that, okay, the band, the concert, all that stuff was written into the script. But in the script, the band was called Nick Nothing and the Hives. That was in the script. That's what they were going to call the band. So they went out and they were going to cast a band to be, Nick Nothing and the Hives. Well, they found this New York City punk band called the Sick Fucks, and both Bob Shea and Jack Shoulder liked the name of that band so much, they just changed the name in the script and let them be the Sick Fucks, which already I think is hilarious. And then the second part of that story is that apparently Jack Palance or one of the band members ran into Jack Palance years later on the street and went up to say hi to him. Was like, hey, we did that movie Alone in the Dark together. I was one of the Sick Fucks in the movie. And Jack Palance apparently said, we were all Sick Fucks in that movie. And I'm like, if Jack Palance ever said that to me, like, if I was just there, standing nearby to that interchange, I think I would have been, like, summoned by lightning back up to vault. Like, this world has nothing left to offer me. I am gone. And I thought that was freaking hilarious. Also, weird thing about this movie, did you notice how many references there were to Springwood? Oh, my, I have a friend over in Springwood that does that. Oh, yeah, the hospital over in Springwood. No. Springwood would become the name of the town where Nightmare on Elm Street takes place 2 years later when New Line put that out, and obviously Bob Shea produced, and Wes Craven was a major, launching pad for him. But it's just, it's like, where did this name come from?
Maybe it was just a name that sounded like a nice generic town.
Yeah.
Kind of like Springfield.
Yeah,
because you can get away with Springfield because there's like 8 Springfields.
This country is crawling with Springfields. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, so Springwood is like Springfield without having a definite location. Like it could be in Illinois. It could be in Tennessee. It could be in California. You just don't know.
Yeah. So Alone in the Dark is a subversive, very, very smart, never cheap, excellent film from start to finish, filled with amazing performances, really strong story structure. Even in its arguably weakest moments, it's still doing something fascinating, yeah. And it still has something to say. And when you consider the fact that the original script was basically goons versus loons, like, I don't know how we got to this point. I don't know where in the rewrite we went, oh, we don't have the money for that, so we're going to do something even better. But I am really glad that it's one of those rare cases where, thank God for budgetary constraints, because that's exactly the catalyst. It's
a much better film.
Yeah, it's a much better film. It's a great horror siege movie. It is not like the slashers you've already seen, and I can't recommend more highly seeking it out. Like I said, I think the DVD is still lingering out there on Amazon. We really need to get a good Blu-ray of this. It's long past due.
Yeah, Shout Factory.
Yeah, Shout Factory. I'm looking at you guys.
Well, I mean, let's face it. Probably not Shout Factory. I mean, it's being a New Line film,
Yeah.
New Line kind of needs to drop it themselves.
Come on, New Line.
Warner Brothers.
Come on. You got all that Hobbit money now. You can take a chance and make a few thousand units of Alone in the Dark on Blu-ray.
Put it on VOD, for fuck's sake.
That's true. That's very true. Because I know at least two people who would be glad to throw down some money to get a high-definition copy of that. And they are the people you're hearing talking right now.
This is a very serious situation.
So let's move on to the junk food pairing, my favorite part of every episode, because it's the part where I also get to eat stuff. So for this week's junk food pairing, I went with Hershey's Special Dark with almonds. Yeah, I'm going somewhere with this.
Yeah, you're going. It's Alone in the Dark with Nuts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, step on the joke, why don't you? Much like the confection from Hershey's, the night is dark and full of nuts. And there's also the rarity connection here, because Hershey's dark chocolate was already deemed special. It's the special dark. But dark chocolate with almonds was even less likely to turn up at your local shop. So Shoulder's career has some special moments, as we mentioned, the hidden Nightmare on Elm Street 2. But Alone,
we didn't mention the rest for various reasons.
For various reasons. But Alone in the Dark is his most special of the specials. It is his first. It is his best. And you should eat a whole hunkin' mouthful of Hershey's Special Dark with almonds as you watch Alone in the Dark. Because, again, the night is dark and full of nuts. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you will come back next week as we will be talking about more of our favorite crazies in films as we continue through March Madness. But once again, you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Find me at twitter.com/massaworm, that's MASSAWYRM, or at facebook.com/massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury. You can find my page on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, or you can head over to oneofus.net, my home away from home. Lots of great geek blogs and geek podcasts over there for your listening and reading pleasure. That's going to do it for this week's show. So for Cargill, this is Brian reminding you that there are no crazy people. We're all just on vacation.